Jovita Das and I have been discussing this week. I'm sure you all know Jovita Das here, a senior transcendentalist of California region. So, you may wonder, what do devotees of Krishna consciousness do when they've been around for 20, 25, 26 years, 30 years? What do they do? Do they do the same thing that the fresh recruits do? Yes. Because the goal of chanting Hare Krishna is to chant more Hare Krishna. So some of you might be thinking, you mean if I get more involved in Krishna consciousness, that I'll simply be singing this same song again and again and again? Just recently I was in Bloomington, Indiana, where the University of Indiana is, and we were having a program there. So before the program, we were doing chanting on the streets. I'm sure you've all seen that. So we passed by one young man on the street, a student, and he looked, listened for a few minutes, and went on his way. And we went to another section of town, and we were chanting, and we came across the same young man, and he looked at us with astonishment. I saw you a half hour ago, but you're still singing the same song. His point was, with his student intelligence, his point was, how could anyone just sing the same song for a half hour? He didn't understand we can sing the same song for many hours. So, change is necessary in the material world because it's a backhanded way of admitting that nothing satisfies you. But you don't tell yourself like that. The way you present it to yourself is that change is just going from one pleasure to another pleasure. When actually, if we're honest, change means going from something that you thought would be pleasurable, but you find out different, so then you have to pick up something else. So therefore, to be successful in life, you try to juggle. You have to juggle so many different things. Now, the proof that there's no real happiness in the material world. There we go again with one of those usual Hare Krishna points. There's no happiness in the material world. Is this something you want your children to hear? Yes? Oh, very wise mother. Generally, parents, they keep this truth hidden. Even when the adults are old and gray in their 60s and 70s. They don't want to let it out that actually nothing they did was really satisfying. How many of you have had parents who tell you that, who told you that? As they were well up in their years, they brought you to them and they said, let's tell you, actually the whole struggle isn't worth it. You should find something else to do than simply follow the pursuits of so-called normal society. Anyone have parents here like that? Well, I guess if there's none like that in Laguna Beach, then there's no hope for the rest of the world. So, generally, what you call the perpetuation of generation after generation, I believe we're discussing this point at Udwarka, our center in Los Angeles, what you call the perpetuation of generations is simply the passing on of the same stale taste from parent to child. That child becomes a parent, passes it to his or her children. The same stale taste. No one will clue you in that don't go this way. Don't follow the route of the general population. No, the parents, they want to see that their children waste their time also, in effect. Oh, it's not like that. You're speaking very severely. What it is that each of us should find our own kind of happiness. And today's parents have realized that you can't impose any strictures or standards on your children because The parents themselves know we want to be happy in our own way, so therefore the children should be happy in their own way. And that leads to a world of peace and cooperation and harmony. When everyone just follows their own heart. So the parents, they accept that, and naturally they can't teach anything to the children. All they can say is, whatever you do, just be happy. As long as it makes you happy, it's all right with me. So people try to fill their life with so many different pursuits, hoping that since one thing can substantially make me happy, if I get a lot of things and juggle them, amidst all the juggling, real happiness will come my way. But if you just look at that juggling act from a different point of view, you'll understand that you have to juggle because you're inadvertently admitting that not one of those things will make me happy. So you're just hoping a combination of them all will somehow or other emit some kind of something known as happiness. And then when you're old and gray, if you live that long, all the juggling pins come crashing down. And then you admit to yourself, what was the point of it all? But then it's too late. Then you're moving on. And where are you going? You don't know. And that's life. That's what the people said. Yes. Of course, when you're young and your senses are vibrant, you don't want to think about these things, especially if you're living in a nice beach area like this. I've been overseas for many years, so this area reminds me of, if any of you have been to Australia, anyone besides Tukaram, anyone that's been to Australia? Yes, yes, he knows. Anyone else? Yes, Emily. She's been to Australia. So the Gold Coast, the Sunshine Coast, you know, where the living is easy. The surf is there, the sun is there, the organic fruits are there, the juice is there, the fresh air is there. So in areas like this, I think it would be safe to say it gets kind of hard sometimes to concentrate on the ultimate goal of life. Or no, what would you say?
Yes, it's hard.
Because, I mean, you know, it's kind of nice, you know. It's kind of hard to think of things like birth, death, disease, and old age. When the surf is crashing down on the beach, the sand is there, the fresh air, the fruits, the surfboards. You just get a feeling that life will just go on like this. So it's especially like that on the Gold Coast and Sunshine Coast of Australia. That's an area around Brisbane, between Sydney and Brisbane. So in places like that, naturally, you can easily become diverted from considering what your real purpose is. Now, people today, they actually don't want to think too deeply about their purpose in life. That's kind of weird. Haven't any of you noticed that? The way society is structured is that the less you think about your ultimate purpose in life, the better a person you are. If you're going to be career orientated, if you're going to be sensuality orientated, why would you want to think too deeply about who you are and why you're here? I mean, there are things to do, places to meet, places to be, people to meet. Your senses need to be active. So society rewards those who do not think. Let me give our friend Emily here. She's visiting from Portland, Oregon, but we first came across her in New Zealand. She was on a skiing trip to New Zealand. But she's given me permission to tell this story. So she spent some time in Krishna Conscious Centers in New Zealand and Los Angeles, and then she went home. She was feeling determined. She was going to integrate what she learned into, you know, mainstream society. These things happen. So she was full of idealism. So as she got home with her family, she was trying to talk to them about consciousness and the ultimate goal of life, all mixed in with, you know, the regular subject matters. And after a while, she began to wonder, based on the response she was getting, who is crazy? Am I crazy or are they crazy? Because no one was kind of picking up on her, you know, on her line of, you know, discussion. Consciousness, the soul, what are we doing in this world, what's our purpose, what's our mission? Everyone's just kind of, you know, just brushing her off, or I guess changing the subject, or just, what are you worried about those things for? So after a while, she began to think maybe there was something wrong with her. So then her mother said to her, I know what the solution is. We'll take you to a psychiatrist. So by that time, she was so flustered by being around people who had no concern with what is reality, what is the self, what is the body, what's the difference between the self and the body, what is consciousness, is it material or spiritual? She got so flustered by being around people who weren't concerned with that at all that she was starting to doubt her own sanity. Well, maybe, yeah, maybe I should go. All right, Mom said, oh, you don't say Mommy, you say Mom. Mom said, I should go, so why not? So she went to the psychiatrist, and so he began to give her the benefit of his years of university training. How many years does it take to be a psychiatrist? 8 years. And of course, probably many years of practice. So he began to explain to her, what you have to do is find something you really enjoy. And when you find something to do that you really enjoy, it'll all happen from that point on. Everything will start to click. Things will just start to get bigger and bigger. How did he say it?
Things, just focus on the thing you enjoy and you'll learn things from that.
Yes. Everything will take off from that point. Find the things that you like. And meanwhile, he was always talking about his well-polished shoes. In other words, showing her, that was his idiosyncrasy, but it made him really happy to have well-polished shoes. So he was spending most of the time talking about his shoes, how brightly shine they were, just to show her that that was his own particular way of being happy, and people would talk about it, compliment him for his well-polished shoes, and he'd feel good about that, and it's all right. So she was supposed to derive profound import from that, that he had well-polished shoes, and that was his way of feeling self-value. She was supposed to really get deep insight. And he went on to say that, you know, Emily, she sometimes is a ski instructor, so I guess he knew that, you know, people sometimes compliment her how physically fit she is, so he admonished her, don't feel bad when people compliment you about your body. This is good. That they're praising you for having a healthy body, you should feel nice, you should like that. And then he began to give her the ultimate instruction. Be secure in your body. Feel good about being the body. Well, let's get into it. Just get rid of the phobias and just be the body, because that's what you are. And just, well, as I used to say in New York City, just let it all hang out. And he also instructed her, don't worry about the afterlife. It's beyond your experience. So why worry about it? So that was the session. And of course, after the session was over, he asked her mother, that'll be $60. And in this way, life goes on. So this is what you go to university for 8 years to study, and then you give this great gift to the people. Just be your body. I mean, do we really need to spend $60 just to hear that we should just be the body and act for our bodily happiness? So at that point, she actually was very thankful to the psychiatrist, because at that point, Emily understood who was really crazy. She realized, it's not me, it's guys like him. So here she is now, once again, visiting our Krishna Conscious Center with some deeper realization. Now, this is the problem we all have. What kind of society are we living in that so blights its population that they can't think straight. And if they do try to think straight, they're made to feel very uncomfortable. We were hearing Srila Prabhupada speak every Sunday in our center in Los Angeles. We play a tape of Srila Prabhupada, his lectures. This one was from 73 in Stockholm. And he was explaining that the way society is constructed is that is a way in which destroys our capacity for higher thinking. We are actually converted into just beasts of burden, and we'll readily work for anything that satisfies our body, and in this way we spend no time in our life for answering the ultimate questions. What is the self? What is the supreme self? What is the nature of consciousness? What is the nature of the supreme consciousness? I was speaking recently with former Prime Minister of New Zealand. Now you might say, oh, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, what's that got to do with the rest of the world? But he's an international player. He's involved very much in the international movers and shakers who are concerned with how society should be arranged for a non-chaotic future. And he told me, yes, there are movers and shakers on that scene, and they do seriously try to come up with blueprints how society should be molded. He said, this is not information for the common man. I mean, what does the common man worry about anyway? So, we were discussing, I was asking a few questions, and he was a bit curious. Based on my questions, his curiosity was aroused. Young man, how do you know these things? Why are you asking these kinds of questions? Because I was asking, so what's the plan? For how the world's supposed to be? Aren't you one of those guys who, are traveling around the world, jetting from capital to capital, discussing the future of humanity and how governments should organize to keep down chaos and keep the corporate profits high? Aren't you one of those? And so he said, well, yeah, I mean, it's not like it's a negative thing. He said, when I was younger and I was more idealistic, I would think that such persons were negative. But now in my older years, I realize that somebody has to control. So if you're sharp enough to understand what's going on, then you become one of the controllers. Otherwise, just be controlled and work and have your sense of dedication and don't worry about it. So he was telling me some of the plans, which he claimed that they'll try first in a small country like New Zealand and then export it to the bigger Western democracies. He said, first of all, you've got to get rid of the middle class. They're too troublesome. They are neither rich nor poor, but they always think they want to control things and give their opinions, especially when they're university educated. So therefore, we want to arrange a society in which people are either haves or have-nots, clearly. Either they are controllers or they are controlled. Nothing in the middle to kind of clutter up the works. And he explained that in the future, the plan is to pay university graduates less than trades persons. You call them that here, trades persons? Like plumbers, electricians, carpenters, like that. That university people should be paid less. In other words, if they want to pretend that their intellect is really affecting society, they can go on living in that illusory world, but they shouldn't get paid for those dreams. And in fact, by them dreaming that their university opinions are actually able to cause a change and that they should be listened to, by them having these hang-ups, they're actually just gumming up the works. So if we pay them less, then they won't feel so proud, and they'll just have to struggle more for their pennies, and they'll be humiliated because the tradespersons will be getting more. So that way it'll make society more easy to manage. And he pointed out that the plan is to give more and more entertainment. The more television channels, the better. You see, in New Zealand, they didn't have television until 1965. So it made a great difference with the adult population. The adult population is actually kind of sharp. Every farmer has read the classics, and in New Zealand, actually, we don't really stress doing university teaching of Krishna consciousness that much, because there's no real difference in intelligence between the average person on the street and a university professor or student. The whole country is kind of like that. And I attribute that to the fact that there wasn't any TV until 65. So they read so much. I think it's at the, on per capita in the world, people read more there than anywhere else. So, now they're having television. They're bringing in the satellite TV, 64 channels, and anyone under 30 regularly goes to the American movies to see the latest productions from Hollywood and like that. So, the former Prime Minister was telling me, there's a plan, well-defined plan to bring in as much television as possible and as much sports as possible. This should be the meditation of the average person. And that way they'll stop thinking about political and economic issues. And that's what's wanted. Once again, he said, if you're sharp enough to see through all this, then just be one of us, be a controller. And if you're not sharp enough to see through it, then don't worry about it. Just have your sense gratification and live happily ever after. So he told me that there is a conscious plan how to do these things. And again, he admonished me. It's not that these people are bad. It's just their understanding that someone has to control, so it might as well be them. And you can work with them in that way. It's not that you can't join the party too. So, in this way, we can see that it is very difficult for a person in society today to become Krishna conscious. Because Krishna consciousness requires intelligence, and everything about society today is working to destroy intelligence. Nowhere in your education, either in high school or university, are you made to understand, what am I? Am I the body or something else? No. Another point we were discussing at New Dwarka, our center in Los Angeles, is that the firm foundation of Western knowledge is matter. Everything is matter. I am matter, the universe is matter. Now, there is a complete correlation between what your cosmology is and what your conception of the self is. When you view the cosmology as just matter, that means you can see yourself as just matter, and the whole purpose of life is simply to enjoy matter. Matter is enjoying matter. But if you're in a completely different cosmology in which you see matter and spirit, then you'll also understand that you yourself are matter and spirit, and you'll have a completely different mission in life. So this is a very important point for us to see. There is a complete correlation between how we view the universe and how we view the self. So Western cosmology means the universe is just matter. And that already defines your mission. You are growing up in a universe of matter, and therefore, obviously you are matter, and you should just try to enjoy matter. And that's all that there is. Just like the psychiatrist told Emily, don't worry about the afterlife, it's beyond your experience. Just enjoy matter now. Look at my shiny shoes. This is the sum and substance of Western knowledge. Now, if you see the cosmos as a combination of matter and spirit, automatically you have a completely different mission in life. So seeing the cosmos as matter and spirit, that is the Vedic view. This is explained by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, I've got two energies. One is interior, the other is superior. The inferior energy, that's matter. It's my energy, but it's inferior. Then there's the superior energy. That is the living entities, who because of their struggling with matter, make things happen. Now, the Vedic culture is completely different because it's focusing upon liberating the spirit self from its material encumbrances. Whereas Western knowledge accepts that all there is matter, so just cavort with matter and enjoy. But our challenge is that if indeed everything is matter, why does anything matter? Why do you lament about the 15 high school students who were killed in Columbine, Colorado? Why do you lament? They just matter. And that's exactly what those two guys were thinking when they were shooting them all. We're all just matter. There's no one in control. There's no superior power. There's no supreme. There's no reactions to what we do, so why not just kill and kill ourselves? And it doesn't matter, because everything doesn't matter. They took the conclusions of Western civilization to their proper end. Everything is matter, so it doesn't matter. And now that's spreading around the high schools in the USA. I was just in Detroit last week, and they arrested a bunch of 12 to 14-year-olds who had a plan to do the same thing that was done in Colorado, but do it much bigger. Once again, based on the music that everyone's listening to, the death metal music and whatever, they're firmly getting the message that the scientists are endorsing. Everything is matter. So therefore, an intelligent high school person says, yes, that's what the scientists say, everything is matter. So, but it's a matter what we do. Now, what are the adults trying to say? But hold on a minute. Everything is matter, but still you have to act nice. And the kids say, well, forget it. If everything is matter, you know, just who cares, you know? If we take some soapy dishwater in the sink and you pull the plug out and it goes down the drain, does anyone lament? So why should we care about people living and dying? So therefore, in Colorado, one of the killers, he walked up to a girl, put his gun to her head. Do you believe in God? She said, yes, I believe in God, and you should follow his path. He said, there's no God. Blew her head off. What? Well, isn't this what the scientists said? There's no God. Everything is matter. But they're trying to enthuse you that you should follow laws and live nicely according to whatever current conventions of nice are. According to whatever the current conventions are of what's nice, that's what you should follow, even though you're just matter. But everyone is saying, look, if we're all matter, then nothing matters. Just do whatever you like. And there you have the formula for social breakdown. Just like in New Zealand, until recently it was very genteel place of British civility, well-mannered. Christianity died there 20 years ago, but still everyone had this sense of British morality and civility. Be well-mannered, be courteous, be respectful of your neighbor, like that. The adults had that, but the kids, they want no part of that. The kids just figure, why should we have this, you know, silly sense of civility and being ladies and gentlemen when, you know, everything is just matter, we should just go for it and do whatever we like. And the adults are trying to restrain them. No, 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 you have to understand that there are nice ways of acting. We should be ladies and gentlemen. And the kids just say, forget that. So that's what's happening in the country. You have the adults who are trying to be well-mannered without Christianity. The adults don't follow Christianity. The churches are all empty. Maybe you have a big church like this, and on Sundays you have 8 old ladies in it. That's about all. So the adults, they are actually proud that they don't follow any religion. Still, they're nice people. They're very proud about that. And they expected their children to follow suit. They never took their kids to church, but they expect their kids to be well-behaved. They expect the girls to, you know, not forget their contraceptives, and they expect the boys to have one girlfriend at a time, and this is basically what they tell their kids. So, peace is supposed to come out of such arrangements? No, anyone can see that the kids are totally lost. They have no material goals or spiritual goals. They're just milling about with no aim in life. And the adults are just pulling their hair. Oh, what to do? Look at my boy. He doesn't want to go to university. He doesn't want to get a good job. You see, in New Zealand and Australia, if you're 17 years old and above and you have no job, the government will give you money. They give you money to the tune of, I'd say, about 100 American dollars a week. Yes, you're 17 years old, you don't go to school, you don't have a job, you can just go to the what's called the social benefits office, and they'll just give you $100 a week. Now, you're supposed to go to report to that office once a month to show them you're looking for a job. But that's a joke because there's very few jobs. So therefore, you have all these young people just getting what they call the dole. They get their $100 a week, they spend it all on intoxication, movies, CDs. They eat every night at McDonald's, and they share apartments together. And they don't work, they don't go to school, they have no idea what will happen to them in the future. And the adults are all horrified. What is happening to our society? What do you mean what's happening to your society? You have arranged a godless society. You have arranged a society which only acknowledges matter. This is the conclusion of Western knowledge. Everything is matter. There's no God. So what do you expect? Now, hopefully, we can understand what the Krishna consciousness effort is up against. Bhagavad Gita is actually giving knowledge. What is the Supreme Consciousness? So, here's a very nice verse to give you some insight. Krishna is explaining. What better authority can there be about the Supreme Lord than the Supreme Lord himself? Now, the thing about Bhagavad Gita is that Krishna can, even though he's infinite, he can incarnate himself to fit into your narrow range of perception. Krishna can do anything, but you can't do anything. Therefore, it is true. On your own, left to yourself and your own devices, you cannot understand the Supreme Lord. Not possible, because you're tiny and limited. But Krishna can explain himself to you, and that way you can understand. Because Krishna has unlimited possibilities, infinite potencies. Even though you're limited, Krishna can arrange that you understand him to some degree. So that's what's happening in Bhagavad Gita. You can't say, oh, how can Krishna speak? How can Krishna give us understanding? Krishna can do anything, whatever he wants. So, in this verse, he's explaining something to his devotee Arjuna. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Bahuni Nedati Tani Janmani Tava Charjuna Tanya Hangveda Sarvani Natsang Veta Parantapa. The personality of God has said, many, many births both you and I have passed. I can remember all of them, but you cannot, O subduer of the enemy. Arjuna, you see, had asked Krishna, you're telling me that millions of years ago you spoke this same knowledge of Bhagavad Gita to the chief living entity in the sun. Now, look, you and I are both the same age. How is it that you can remember speaking this knowledge millions of years ago to the chief living entity in the sun? I don't remember that. You mean to tell me that you can remember things from previous appearances? And Krishna is answering. Many births you and I have gone through. I remember all of them, but you cannot. So, this is very significant. Krishna is saying that Arjuna, even though you are my dear associate, you are not omniscient. I remember everything, but you don't remember at all. Even though you're my perfect companion, still you are limited consciousness. You cannot be omniscient. I, however, remember everything because I am unlimited consciousness. I, therefore, know everything. Krishna remembers exactly what he did. So he told Arjuna, many millions of years ago, I spoke the same knowledge to Vibhishan, chief of the Aryans. In other words, don't think that my memory is limited to the 100 or so years that I've been on Earth. No, I can remember millions of years back. Now, Arjuna travels with Krishna from universe to universe, enacting this same pastime again and again of having Bhagavad Gita spoken to him. But he doesn't remember. Whereas Krishna remembers everything. So sometimes people think that spiritual perfection means I'll know everything. That's like saying, if you're a pure devotee of Krishna, you should be able to tell me the score of the soccer game in Mexico City last night. Because if you're pure and perfect in Krishna consciousness, you should know everything. But no. To be pure and perfect in Krishna consciousness means to know whatever Krishna wants you to know. Even in your perfect stage, you are dependent on Krishna. You cannot become independent of Krishna. Purity and perfection in Krishna consciousness means that you're an instrument in Krishna's hands without any resistance. That is what the Lord tells Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. Nimitramatram bhava savyasachin. You just be an instrument for me in this battle. That is the perfection. You can't become omniscient because you're limited in consciousness. This is explained in the 13th chapter of the Gita. Krishna says, I'm the knower in everybody, but you're the knower in your body only. And we don't even know all the things that are going on in our body. We have knowledge that I have a finger, but actually what's going on inside this finger, we don't know exactly and completely. But Krishna knows both ways, directly and indirectly, about everyone and everything. And it's easy for Krishna, because everyone and everything is Krishna's energy. But everyone and everything is not our energy. So therefore, in our perfect state, we still are limited. In that, whatever Krishna wants us to know, we'll know. And otherwise, we won't. So Arjuna doesn't know about his past appearances of Krishna. And you can read in Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna's associates like Yudhisthira, the other Pandavas, they don't remember. They just 100% engage themselves in Krishna's activities, but they're not thinking, oh, I remember before. No. And it's not necessary for them to know that in order to be pure and perfect devotees of Krishna. They simply know whatever Krishna wants them to know. You see, the main thing about associating with Krishna in perfection is to have pleasure. And in Vrindavan, that's the topmost pleasure realm for Krishna and his associates. In Vrindavan, they don't even entertain the thought that Krishna can be supreme. They just know Krishna is the most attractive lover, the most attractive friend, the most attractive child. So bhakti yoga is a bit tricky in that it's based on knowledge, but the ultimate end is beyond knowledge. Even Krishna likes to forget that he's God and just have a good time. So sometimes we misunderstand this. Because bhakti is composed of jnana and vairagya, knowledge and detachment. But ultimately, in its highest capacity in the spiritual world, bhakti is just spontaneous attraction to Krishna because Krishna is all attractive. Not based on knowledge. The residents of Vrindavan, they don't even know that Krishna is God. Therefore, when Krishna was in danger with the Putana witch, and then Krishna triumphed in the situation, what did Mother Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj do? They thought, Krishna came out of that situation okay because we prayed to Vishnu. We were worshiping Vishnu, and therefore Krishna was taken care of. They don't think Krishna is God, therefore he triumphed. They think, no, because of our worship of Vishnu, therefore Krishna is okay, our baby Krishna. Also about Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes devotees think that because Srila Prabhupada, he's a pure, perfect devotee of Krishna, therefore he knows everything. He knew everything. No. As Jivita Prabhu was pointing out in Los Angeles, Srila Prabhupada himself explained the perfection of the acharya, or the pure teacher of Krishna consciousness, is his teaching of Krishna consciousness. Not that he's omniscient. It doesn't mean that Srila Prabhupada should have been able to tell us the score of these soccer games around the world because he's plugged into Krishna, therefore he should know everything. No. The perfection is that he preaches the science of pure devotion and exemplifies it. Just like, for example, you all, many of you know about our gorgeous temple in Bombay, Juhu Beach. So, to get that land and temple, Srila Prabhupada personally had to go through a huge legal real estate battle because the owner was cheating. Now, Prabhupada, after it was all finished and the battle was won with the cheating developer, Prabhupada said, ordinarily, with my business ability, I would have seen that that man's a cheater. But Krishna covered me over so that I would enter into the deal. So this shows how to be a pure devotee simply means you are dependent on Krishna, whatever Krishna wants to know. I was just reading Srila Prabhupada answering questions in Mexico City. So someone asked him, when everyone offers food to your picture, do you know about it? Are you aware when everyone's offering their food to your picture? And Prabhupada said, not necessarily. He said, but Krishna is conscious, and through Krishna the devotee is conscious. So this is a very important point for us to understand, because sometimes devotees, they say, well, Prabhupada, he was omniscient, therefore he must have known this or he must have known that. No, to be a pure devotee means you're just an instrument in Krishna's hands, and you're moved wherever, however Krishna wants you to move for his purposes. Even Arjuna, he's wondering, Krishna, how is it you remember talking to Vivaswan, the sun god, and I don't remember? So Krishna told him, that's the difference between me and you. Many births, many appearances you and I have gone through. I remember all of them. You don't. Now, actually, for Krishna, there's no birth or death. Also, for the individual soul, there's no birth or death. We seem to be going through births and deaths because we're encumbered with this body. Now, there's also no birth and death for Krishna, but that's not because Krishna has a material body covering his spirit soul. No. Krishna always has a spiritual body. He never takes on a body of matter. Therefore, Krishna's knowledge is always intact. Because he never takes on a material body, and because he's unlimited. So these are interesting points to understand for our regular audience. These are some very tasty intricacies about Krishna consciousness. Perfection for the jiva, for the time-living entity, does not mean to be omniscient. It means to be a perfect instrument in the hands of the Lord. Look at Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. Sometimes Krishna wants him to know, and sometimes not. Krishna purposely put Arjuna into illusion. Okay, you are my pure devotee. In order to stage this Bhagavad Gita speaking, you have to lament. You've got to start identifying with your kinsman in the bodily conception. So we'll teach everyone a lesson, what it's like to go through the bodily conception of life. So Arjuna, he's plunged into Maya. And then Krishna explains Bhagavad Gita to him, and he comes out of Maya. He's just doing Krishna's bidding. So he's not in Maya like we can be in Maya. He's going through a dramatic performance arranged by the Supreme Lord. Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita do you find a verse where Krishna says, and when you become my devotee, you'll be omniscient. He says, you'll know everything. That means you'll know everything possible that a limited living entity can know about Krishna. Srila Prabhupada wants to find a devotee in this way. A devotee is one who knows something about everything and everything about something. A devotee knows everything about Krishna. That means as much as is possible for a limited living entity to understand about the Lord, the devotee knows. And the devotee knows something about everything. In the course of serving Krishna, he may know how to fix a car, he may know how to do carpentry, he may know how to do management, he may know how to do editing. All in the course of serving Krishna, he's picked up so many little different things. Any questions?
Talk about this Colorado example.
Mm-hmm.
Why do those innocent people have to pay the price of some ignorance of some people because they are after matter or whatever they believe in? How do you explain the reason for people to suffer because of the ignorance of those two boys?
There is no injustice in the cosmic manifestation. Every one of us, we all get our just desserts. This is the law of karma. Action and reaction. There's no injustice in the cosmos.
Are you telling us that these are the karma of those people who get killed?
Yes.
They deserve to be get killed.
According to actions in the past life. That doesn't mean we condone such a thing, of course, that is horrible. But at the same time, we recognize that these are the reactions of karmic activity. Therefore, if you really are compassionate, you should teach people how to stop karmic activity. In other words, we just don't sit back and say, it was all their karma. They're getting their just results. They're reaping what they sowed. No, we're working full time teaching people how to stop karma. We're working full time for the solution.
That is for the next life, not for this life.
In this life, you can stop your karma. Bhakti Yoga, Krishna says at the end of Gita, you have read Gita, yes?
Yes?
At the end of Gita, Krishna says, pile all your responsibilities on me for your past activities. I'll take care of it. You don't worry. You just do what I say. And from this point on, I handle your reactions. Don't worry. Yes? I have to ask our president. Yes? Okay. The boss has told me to take my time. Alright. So, suppose you have many problems. You've got problems in school, you've got problems with your finances, problems with romance, on, on, on. And then someone says, just come to me, I solve all the problems, you don't worry. What would you say? You'd be very happy. So that's what Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita. But we're doubtful. I don't know. Or else we even say, actually, I kind of like my problems. By having problems, I feel like I exist. What will happen to me if I don't have problems anymore? What will I do? Sometimes people ask like that. Well, if everyone becomes Krishna conscious, how will the world go on? If everyone lives like you guys, how will the world proceed? Prabhupada would answer, don't worry, not everyone's going to do it. There'll always be some less intelligent persons. They can push on business as normal. Yes?
In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna told Arjuna, actually, he's singing the song to Arjuna because of the Mahabharata going on. Okay, and he's telling what is going on. He says you can achieve the salvation by two methods. Salvation to the Lord. And one is dharma and one is karma. Dharma means you must devote to me and achieve the salvation. Karma says, and there's another part is karma. Karma means say that not anybody can devote the whole life to the Krishna or to the God. Nobody can, the very few people can do it because they have to dedicate their whole life on this one matter. So he said, there's another way to achieve the salvation, which is karma. Karma means the way I tell you to do the job. This is my way of thinking. So in a sense, the karma is a part of salvation, not as a something to be said that is.
Alright. So in Bhagavad Gita, many approaches to bhakti are discussed. Karma Yoga is discussed as an approach to bhakti. Jnana Yoga is discussed as an approach to bhakti. Jnana Yoga is discussed as an approach to bhakti. In other words, you can approach bhakti through performing activities that you're attached to, but giving some of the results to Krishna. You can approach bhakti through speculation about what is matter, what is spirit, what is eternal, what is temporary. You can approach bhakti through dhyana, meditation, trying to get a glimpse of the super soul within. But these are just approaches to the transcendental loving service of the Lord. These are just approaches to the art, science, culture, and philosophy of pleasing Krishna senses. So sometimes it is easy to make that mistake that, oh, in Gita there are so many methods. Krishna says this way, that way. Now, even if you think that there are many different ways presented in Gita, I'd like to give you an answer that Prabhupada gave. He said, even if you think that Krishna is saying, do this, and then he says, do that, and so many different approaches, what's the last thing he says? Just like if I tell you on Monday, please go to the hardware store and get this. Then on Wednesday I say, please go here and do that. So I may give you so many instructions, and it may be confusing. But you'll take seriously the last thing I said. So in Bhagavad Gita, the last thing Krishna says is sarva dharma vrityaja. Abandon all your conceptions of what is dharma and just do what I say. That's the last word. So even if you think there's a contradiction, there's no contradiction, there's no many different solutions. But even if you think that, all right, still you take the last thing Krishna said. That will make things simple. Other questions? Any of our guests for the first time or second time? I didn't say anything bad for your kids, did I? Thank you. Kids, you understood everything? Anyway? All right, thank you very much, Hare Krishna.